Welcome back to the PokePod. I'm Sarah, the co-founder of PokeMind, and I'm very excited to be back behind the microphone or for a new episode. It's been some time, but we're here. And we're joined today by two amazing guests, my colleague Maria from PokeMind. Welcome, Maria.
Thank you. It's so good to be here. It's my first podcast in my life, so I'm really excited, and I'm glad it's on such an important topic. So I'm a licensed psychologist, psychotherapist in training, living and working in North Macedonia, where I work in counseling, and I'm a part of PokeMind, and I also do a lot of community work on psychoeducation through public lectures, seminars, and experiential workshops.
Well, welcome, Maria. We're happy to have you here. We're also joined here by Priscilla from Vivify Therapy, and we're very honored to have you here. Welcome, Priscilla.
Thank you, Sarah. Hi, I'm Priscilla. I'm from Vivify Therapy. I'm a psychotherapist in the UK, and I founded Vivify Therapy during lockdown to support underserved communities. So I'll talk a bit more about what Vivify does shortly.
Yes. Welcome, Priscilla. So for those who might be new to our podcast, let me quickly share what we're all about. So PokeMind is an AI platform working to make mental health support more accessible and inclusive for everyone. So you can go on the app, app.pokemind.com, and just start chatting with our AI in your language and receive instant support for your mental health that is curated by our psychologist, of which Maria here is sitting. So if you need any help, just go on there. And we also partner with organizations like Vivify Therapy, who are doing incredible work in making therapy more accessible and culturally responsive. Please tell us more, Priscilla, on what you do.
Yeah, so Vivify Therapy is a social enterprise. So what that means is that our core foundation is built on serving the community. And we do this through one-to-one psychotherapy and counseling, which is delivered online. But we also do in-person community-based therapy. And we do this through workshops. So we will cover a range of common mental health disorders from depression, anxiety, and all the other kind of symptoms and issues that are very common. But we target these into underserved communities. And in the UK, this typically means people from African and Caribbean backgrounds. So those are the people that we mainly work with, but sometimes we will extend our work out to other underserved communities as well. So our core streams look at working with students, so students who are in college or university, and how mental health might be a barrier to them achieving academic success or just thriving in their lives in general outside of academia. So we deliver programs in partnership with academic institutions to support them to be able to thrive. And then the second strand of work that we do is working with entrepreneurs and founders and people who are self-employed to make sure that they can run their businesses successfully, especially early stage founders and young founders. We're really keen to support them, people who are from underserved backgrounds, as they have so many barriers to achieving success already. And then lastly, the third strand of Vivify is cultural competence. So we work with organizations who are training new therapists and counselors to make sure that they don't continue the bias that we sometimes see in the mental health space.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. And you target also very specific niche and people that are usually underserved. So I think that's perfect for today's topic. Today we're diving into a crucial conversation about mental health accessibility, like I said, and particularly focusing on underserved communities and how we can break down the barriers to mental health care. So we'll be also exploring everything from systemic barriers to practical solutions, and I couldn't think of better guests to have this conversation with. But before we dive into the specific challenges faced by underserved communities, I'd love to hear from both of you what drew you into this work in the first place. So maybe you can tell us a little bit more, both Maria and Priscilla. Okay.
Maria, would you like to go first? Or
I don't mind.
Go ahead.
So what drew me is the big systemic barrier of poverty that that is kind of one of the main reasons why people here don't access quality mental health support and services. And this is often combined with a lack of education on what we do as therapists, as counselors, what is our profession, what is our role in society, what we can offer. So these go kind of hand in hand, where people are afraid of the concept of a psychologist, of a counseling session, of a therapist, of therapy in general, but also they do not have the resources when they find themselves in distressing times, in times of trouble, of mental health issues and things like that. So it's not only that they do not have funds, resources to invest in prevention, and they're not educated about mental health prevention, but also when crisis strikes, they do not have the resources to commit to a therapeutic journey, this whole process, because it's just not just going once and going twice. It's a lot more work than that. So often people are feeling excluded from the discourse around therapy and from the tools and resources that we have to share with them. And the community work is very, very important here. First, in making the concept of mental health services available and more accessible to people, to get them to learn what therapy can do for them, how it can enrich their lives, or how it can support their communities in a larger sense. And then to find ways to make these services accessible. And a lot of this in my community, in my country, is done through this type of community work. It's much less done on the policy level, on the, you know, on the highest level, on the government level, policies that make these services affordable, or campaigns that can bring them closer to the people in need. It's much more left on individuals, on groups, on small organizations of like-minded professionals to do this for the community and bring these services where they're most needed. So this is what inspired me in a way. I mean, you see it every day, and when you're working in this field, it's impossible to not notice it. And it is a big motivator for me, because it's very easy to work with people who have the funds to pay you well, or it's very easy for people who have the funds to go in private healthcare and get their needs met and get the services they need on a very quality level. But what is happening with the majority of the population that is constantly excluded from this process? It's kind of a huge issue.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting and very different from the system itself in Sweden. But I'll touch upon that in a bit, because I would still like to hear more about Priscilla's experience as well. But I think you're right on point, Maria.
Yeah, Maria's explanation links so much to my experience as well. I feel like a lot of therapists in this space, we are led by passion and we're led by our own experience. So you often create something that you need for yourself. And I feel like that was my experience coming into it. When I started my training, and also just observing some of the like mental health issues around me in London, it felt like there was so much emphasis on the individual level. And as we know, like once you start doing this work, there is only so much improvement that can be made if you do not tackle like things on a systemic level. So like Maria touched on, like poverty and access and education around mental health, how do you even know you need support if you don't recognize the symptoms that your mental health is bad in the first place? So that's what really led me to creating Vivify Therapy as well. And I realized that mainstream therapy in the UK, the language that was being used, felt very disconnected from underserved communities. It didn't feel accessible. The way the services are marketed, people don't even really know about it. And the therapist, it's a very white space. It's very white, it's very female, it's very old. So this kind of like eliminates a lot of people. And I don't say that to be ageist, but even when you look at sort of training programs here in the UK, there wasn't much age diversity in terms of lecturers and teachers. So it kind of gives this energy of like Freud and Carl Jung, like, you know, like a very old type of industry. Yeah. Like, okay, we need to bring it like into the 21st century, and mental health as an industry needs to be more reflective of like all of society, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's what led me to kind of design Vivify Therapy in a way where it felt more accessible. The first time I ever experienced psychotherapy from the client's perspective or patient's perspective was during secondary school. Now, I was quite lucky to go to a high school that was very diverse. In London, I had diverse teachers, staff, and they were very helpful. Like if they recognized symptoms, they would refer you to a counselor. So I remember one day, it was actually me and a group of friends. We had fallen out and we decided we didn't want to be friends anymore. And we were like arguing and we wouldn't focus in class. And the teacher said, I think you guys would benefit from going to group therapy during your lunch break. So they sent us to this therapist and she was amazing. And she was a Black woman and we were all Black and mixed students. So just having that safe space to speak to somebody and realizing like the power and the transformation of just understanding my own mental health really gave me like a positive experience. And I definitely credit that therapist to why I've even taken this on as a career. My second experience was quite different. So when I was at university, I had therapy from a German woman, and as she was very skilled, very competent, but the connection just wasn't there. And I noticed that I would close up because we just came from two very different worlds and there wasn't an understanding of my cultural context. And I don't think this is because she is a bad person or anything like this. It was just, you don't understand me and my lived experience. So that was also like an inspiration for me to say, okay, we need more therapists like me who understand people like me, because there are so many of us here. So that kind of like summarizes my inspiration for coming into this space.
I mean, that's very interesting. I think like a lot of people share that kind of experience. I think also I tried to go to therapy once in my life because I was dealing with some issues at home, and then I was like, okay, I'm gonna go talk to someone, and I tried BetterHelp, but I got matched with a psychologist from the US, and I was just sitting there trying to explain to her everything, but I just felt like this connection between the two of us, because I felt like she was trying to be so sensitive that it felt insensitive. I know it was not her intention at all, and I'm sure she's a lovely person as well. It's just I didn't feel that connection because we didn't have the same background, the same cultural experience, the same experience, I guess, experiences as well, you could say. And at school, I think I would have needed to go to therapy quite a lot because I moved from Tunisia to Sweden, and I know I spoke the language a little bit, so I had a lot, like I was very privileged in that sense. But I was also very alone because I was the diversity of my class. And I felt like it was me and then them in the class. And I would have loved to talk to someone that would have understood that kind of feeling, but those kinds of services were not really offered. Or yeah, I didn't even know that you could go to therapy at that age. I was like, yeah, it's something that they do on TV, you know? That is way far away from me. So I think that is something that we also need to start talking about at school, that if you have an issue or you're feeling like you need to talk to someone, that there are people that can relate and that can help you out. And I think that's a massive problem for a lot of people that just go through their educational years without talking to someone and struggling for themselves. Do you have a similar experience, Maria, or I don't know if you encountered one that had this experience?
I can just add that unfortunately here, school psychologists, they exist. So the job is there, and it's not functioning. It's not working. They are so overwhelmed. Schools are so underfunded. They do administrative work. They do the work of the pedagogists, they do multiple roles at once, and they're used as scarecrows for kids. You know, when you're messy and you get into trouble, you're sent to the psychologist. And the people who do this, who are the school psychologists, they often are have these very outdated methods and approaches to children, and children do not respond well to that. So it's I mean, there are a lot of people who try and do a lot of good, but in general, it's a little bit of an issue. It's sometimes it's an urgent issue in some communities, and children really don't have a good access to mental health services. Parents are rarely in the position to recognize signs on time. I mean, they're rarely well educated themselves to just validate and to seek help for their children when something happens. And also, the schools are not really responsive, not very, you know, modern in their approach, not very well funded, as I said, to provide the services on a quality level. So it's sad because generations and generations are kind of slipping through this educational system that is not serving them well in mental health. And also there is a huge painful lack of education for these kids about what is mental health and how do we do basic mental hygiene and how do we prevent things from happening? How do we, you know, learn not to stigmatize others for their potential mental health issues and things like that. So it's kind of a painful topic around here about kids and how you treat them and how you access them. Because parents, sometimes the parents who have the funds, parents will sometimes bring children to therapy and they will be like, I'm bringing a car to the auto mechanic, you know, so here it is, please fix it and return it back to me. So they tend to also forego responsibility in the process. But when I was listening to you speaking, I was reminded that I work a lot online with expats from Macedonians who live in other communities, and I hear from them how difficult it is to seek, receive the help that they need in a way that feels culturally sensitive and competent. So they often reach out to psychologists, therapists, counselors back home to have that cultural link and you know, to really feel heard and seen in a way that helps them work on them their issues better and faster and more efficiently. So I have a lot of understanding for that, and I can really respect this perspective.
Yeah, you've touched upon so many points. Like, it is a big topic, and I'm hoping that with this conversation that we would be able to provide more support to underserved communities and just students in general and anyone that would need this kind of help. Because I mean, yeah, stigma is also a big part of why people don't seek help, and it's been seen as something that is out of the ordinary to go and talk to a therapist. Like, you have to be very or more like the view that I had was you have to be very on the edge of breaking down to go talk to someone, when that is not necessarily the case. Sometimes you just need to talk to someone, even if you're not at that point, or you just need some help to not reach that point. So I think that's also a good point. So yeah. But Priscilla, do you have any, like, what kind of services are provided to underserved communities in the UK? I'm thinking that we could take a round and just kind of see what is out there, but also because Maria touched upon how in North Macedonia that you don't have these kind of policies on a governmental level that would provide these services to, for example, immigrants or more minority communities. So maybe you can, Priscilla can start, and then Maria, you can touch upon that as well.
Yeah. So in the UK, therapy is mainly provided through the National Health Service, and it's usually, it's free at the point of contact. So this therapy is kind of a standard type of therapy that is provided through the NHS, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. And typically this is delivered over 12 weeks. So if you are seen to have symptoms that are, you know, that can be worked through using CBT, then you'll be matched with a CBT therapist and you'll be given 12 weeks. Now things have started to shift more recently, where In addition to having like those 12 weeks of therapy, which would either be delivered in person or online, like through a video call, we now have apps as well. We have a few mental health apps where it teaches you psychoeducation to understand your mind. So you kind of use this in combination with the one-to-one therapy. However, for us that are in the mental health industry, we know that CBT isn't always the best approach to all types of mental health issues, especially if you're working with non-Western cultures where we have very specific beliefs, like you mentioned, Sarah, where you have to kind of be on the brink of a breakdown before you even ask for help. So if you take somebody who has these beliefs, and often that is the confusion when you are somebody who comes from one culture, you're living another culture, and help is available to you, but then you go home, like for myself and the people that I knew, and your family are like, stress? What is stress? You're in a first world country, you have money, you have a nice house, you have everything, you don't have stress. You know, it kind of invalidates you, and you feel like, oh, maybe I can just keep pushing. So I think if you then go to CBT therapists, where it's kind of it can touch on the surface, I believe, of what some of these symptoms are, but it doesn't address the deep rooted issues. It also doesn't address like the societal issues as well. So I think over time, we have around like a 14% of Black and minority population in the whole of the UK. It seems like a small number, but in London, it's very concentrated where I live. So the majority of that 14% are in London. But I would say UK-wide, policies are starting to shift, and the government is realizing that mental health needs to be more of a priority. And with that, they are starting to allocate more funding to healthcare services. We also have charities in the UK as well that work specifically with marginalized communities. So whether it be a service that is like for Black people or for Syrians or for the Somali community or migrants, we have so many different charities, and sometimes these charities will come together and they will do like a large project where people can access therapy for free. And I find that that is really useful as well, because the marketing, the language, the therapists are diverse, and people are much more likely to access these services. Also, because they are smaller charities, they're able to deliver therapy sometimes in the language of the patient or the client. But typically in the NHS, you would get therapy in English, which can sometimes be a barrier as well. So those are some of like the key changes. But I would say the conversation on mental health in the UK has come a long, long way. And yeah, there is a lot of support and enthusiasm around it as well.
I mean, that's amazing to hear. So it's completely different than where I am. That's it. I'll let Maria talk first.
Here, so our healthcare system, like, it's divided into the public state healthcare and the very small private sector. And so, of course, the public healthcare is almost free. It's very, very cheap here to access these services, but it is riddled with structural systemic problems. You know, we have it's underfunded, it's understaffed, it has a lot of corruption, it's falling apart, basically. It's something that we still have from the socialist era of Yugoslavia. It's a system that is slowly disintegrating, and it will fall apart and everything will become private, I'm sure. So it is accessible, this, you know, this infrastructure of clinics and hospitals and community centers and everything in between. But it is very low quality. It can mean that you have to wait a lot, very, very long time before you get access to a service. You know, you need a psychologist or a psychiatrist right away. You have urgent mental health issues. It might take a lot of time before you get to the service. And once you get to the service, it does not guarantee that it will serve you well at all. It can actually cause more damage in certain cases than, you know, help you. So because the workers, the people who work there, you know, the professionals in these fields, they are stressed, they're overwhelmed. I have worked for a couple of years I have worked for a lot of years in the state sector, in state healthcare, but a couple of years in a psychiatric hospital. And it's like a factory lane. People are just entering and exiting, and you don't have a lot of time to really connect with them. You don't have a lot of time to empathize, to understand their perspectives, you know, to build something together, to build trust or whatever, to really pay them attention. So you're just, you know, making profiles and giving assessments and getting the results and just making sure that everybody has a diagnosis, and then get the therapy and leave, and they're coming back again in a couple of months. So it's really inefficient. It's really inefficient in its core. And people do not feel heard or seen or supported in a very substantial way. You know, they get the therapy, the medications, they leave. They are never educated in a real sense how to take care of themselves when they leave this institution or while they're there in the first place. So all of these services where you can get a psychologist, I mean, not only about patients who stay at hospitals, people who are also coming to the day centers for psychological care, they get an irregular quality of mental health services, and it's a huge issue. It's a big reason why people, you know, give up and say, "So okay, I don't need a psychologist. Like this doesn't work. I'm gonna struggle on my own. I'm gonna find other ways. I'm gonna drink myself death or whatever." And then we have the private sector, where it is a ridiculously expensive in most cases to receive this very well. I mean, really quality help and support and everything. And not a lot of people can afford it. And then we have the situations where people cannot afford it for on time, you know, before it gets to the brink of being destroyed and devastated by a crisis, as you mentioned, Sarah. So when it's time for prevention, for early intervention, they cannot afford it. So they will save up money when it comes to like the end, you know, like I have to go somewhere now, or I don't know if I'm going to survive. And then they will just give that money for a couple of sessions there, or to speak with a psychiatrist a couple of times. So it's not also very efficient for the largest part of the population as well. Of course, there is a segment of the population that can afford that, but it's not the majority. And this discrepancy is really, really felt, you know, in the public here. You can see it first and foremost in the attitudes that people have towards mental health and mental health services. They do not believe in it, by and large. You know, it's not something that it comes to their mind like a natural thing. Like, you know, I have a toothache and I'm going to go to the dentist because, of course, that's what you do when you have a toothache. It's not how they think about mental health and mental health care.
Yeah, I think it's also very intangible, or like it's not something that you can, like, that is physically painful, or you can see that you can show people and they would believe you. Because yeah, mental health is something that is internal oftentimes, and then they can be invalidated very easily, like Priscilla talked about. And I think most of the issues that you talked about, Maria and Priscilla as well, are very similar kind of everywhere, because I've heard kind of the same issues here in Sweden. And I mean, for my research, since I'm not a psychologist myself, so I don't have firsthand experience of the healthcare system, but I looked into it, and also I've talked to people that came from Syria and immigrated here to Sweden and so on. And I just found out that there is a health examination that all immigrants and asylum seekers are entitled to. And the purpose of this is to find the health needs that are both physical and mental, that need urgent care, but also to prevent infectious diseases. And what studies have shown is that the healthcare system, since all municipalities get to kind of interpret that law, they've decided to only focus on examining the infectious diseases part. So all the resources went to that, to make sure that no diseases get spread in society, which of course is very important. But then what happens to the mental health and the physical health? And they kind of wrote that they touch upon it sometimes, and if the person is kind of closed up or says nothing, then they won't follow it, even if they know that there's something off. That if they say they're not sleeping well or they're not eating well, they won't pursue that area because they don't have the resources to do that, and all the focus is put on the infectious diseases and making sure that they don't have those. So over time, what happened was that the participation in this health examination has, well, decreased, and these people don't trust the system. So as of 2017, there was less than 50% of those entitled to these health examinations that participated in them. And we can all guess some of the reasons why, but also lack of communication of what you can get and what you cannot get. Also some language barriers. It's all kind of a lot of structural barriers that do not let them get the help that they need, even though they are entitled to mental health help if they need it, you know? So they do not know that they can seek it because of how the municipalities have framed the law and the framework that they have and that they're working from. So I think it's a bit sad that we're not using it. And something else that I know that we provide is therapy over the phone. So you can call anyone or like call this line and then ask for help. And you can ask it for a person or to speak in your language. But how they do this is that they have one psychologist on one line and then an interpreter on one line and the other person on one line. So some information kind of gets lost in the translation and you cannot connect freely with the therapist or psychologist. And I've heard that both the psychologist and the person seeking help feel frustrated because it's not really effective, or like it's not really personal anymore if you need someone else on the phone just listening and translating, whereas you can simply just go see someone that speaks your language if they wanted to. Like, they can invest in people that can speak their language. There's so many people that speak Arabic here, and there are so many people, yeah. You know, like, if they wanted to, they could invest some money into making sure that these people get the mental health support that they need, because they are more prone to depression than the natives, and they are more prone to post-traumatic experiences because they come from regions that are affected by war. They probably didn't come out of free will. So I think it's a big issue that we need to kind of address. But the only way we're doing it is by private practice, but private practice is very expensive. Like, I don't think we can afford 140 euro therapy session every week. I think it's very expensive for the average person. So I guess that's where all these mental health apps and all these communities and charities that are coming out are trying to help and fill in that gap that exists in the system and help these people out.
Yeah, I felt, for example, in my community that the surgeons of online therapy and online counseling made such a big difference. People rushed to try this thing out. People that would not otherwise reach for traditional therapy every week for those prices that are usual here, and it was a real boom, and I'm really happy for it. The format is limiting, of course, but it's this initial contact with having a mental health service, with having your therapist, psychologist, etc. That it really helps them just to get into the process. And some of them continue with traditional therapy later after they have some initial exposure to how does this looks and what do we do here and how does it serve you. But for most of them who remain in online therapy, it was groundbreaking. It was really groundbreaking. A thing that made it accessible to people who would never otherwise do it. I'm really happy for it. I mean, I have my grievances with the digital technologies boom in general, you know, and how it sometimes ruins personal contact. But there are things that are very, very valuable, like priceless, for the people who before that didn't have good access to mental health care.
Yeah.
And we have to admit that. Yeah.
But I think how can we make it, how can we more like come out to that information to these people, reach out to these people and let them know that this help exists? Because I think that's also one of the barriers, that we cannot simply just reach them in an easy way. Maybe Priscilla, you know how to do that, or you've had experience with reaching out to them.
Yeah, I mean, there are some methods that I've tested, and I think that's kind of just come by way of me already having some contacts with these communities, so it's made it easier for me in a way. One of the things quite early on that helped us was to partner with local organizations. So for example, close to where I live, there is a vegan restaurant, which also has, it has like a workspace inside it. So it tends to be quite a hub for, you know, Black professionals who are on a health journey and who are learning about veganism and healthy eating. And because we noticed that, and they were running small events already, we decided to like integrate some of our mental health workshops in those type of spaces. And once we realized like people were really keen to come, we got quite creative with it. So what we did was run a series of evenings where we promoted mental health, but we used film and we used music. So we would have a movie night and everybody would watch the movie, but we selected movies that had key mental health themes for the Black community. And then after we watched the movie, we would have a discussion. So because we promoted it as a movie night in like a place that was already popular and people go to hang out, it made it more like enticing for them to want to come. And then when they came there, they were like, oh, I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but I had fun and I also learned about mental health. So I think sometimes just getting creative and partnering with like local businesses that have that in-person like touch, that community touch, is a good way. But I'm also super excited about how digital services can democratize this access to mental health services, because, you know, money is a barrier, whether it's like traveling or allowing therapists to reduce our fees because we're not paying for offices and therefore we can charge a you know, a lower rate. So I think the online as well, promoting of the online services. But I do find that sometimes people are apprehensive about online therapy unless they've met me in person. So I try to network in person as much as I can, and let people get to, you know, sense me and sense the other therapists that we work with, and then they can have the online therapy. But I think with the apps as well, it's about really communicating the energy of the brand and their expectations. So for example, like with Poker Mind and being able to offer therapy through different languages, I think that is amazing. And so many people would rush to want to use that, because I don't know of many platforms that are able to offer services in other languages. So already, you know, that's like a really key feature that people should know about. And I think it's great.
I mean, I really like the idea of the movie night. I think it's actually very creative, and getting people there and then talking about something that is within your field, and like the marketing, I think is very interesting. We definitely need to become slightly more creative, I think, in the way we market ourselves, because I think people can benefit a lot from Pokemind and just sitting there and reflecting on their experiences and getting immediate help, even if it's not a real person in that setting. I think it could help out just to like also know what you want in life, you know, and where you want to go, and then before you even go to a psychologist or a therapist. But I think we have some a long way to get there, to let people know that we are there and we're here to help you out. We've created this because we want to help you out, because we've struggled ourselves with similar problems, and we know how difficult it can be to simply just reach out to a person or to a psychologist in the first place and make that step and admit that you just need help, because it's a hard thing to do. Like, I don't want to admit I need help, but sometimes we need to do that for our own sake, I think. So
opposite story on the creative initiative of Priscilla, which is amazing. Like in my experience with my colleagues, when we were faced with an underserving community, we went and got them the support, the help they needed right where they were. It was the Clinic of Oncology here in Skopje. I've told Sarah, I think, about it once. There was no psychologist employed at the Clinic of Oncology, which houses hundreds of patients. There was no one in-house to take care of their mental health needs. And we organized as a group of students, recent graduates, psychologists, experienced psychotherapists, and made our little project where we went and made sure that every day there is two shifts of in the very least of psychologists who volunteer their time to at certain segments of the hospital where we thought there was the greatest risk and the greatest need. So we just went there and serviced those people for 2 years almost. And on the weekends, the more experienced therapists and psychologists would lead group therapy, workshops, everything free, like a couple of hours of psychological support and guidance for free. So it was a very comprehensive project that lasted for a long time. And with that, those of us who are more experienced or interested in psychometrics did a research from this population that we were serving. Basically, we did a research about their levels of depression, anxiety, stress, post-traumatic stress, before surgery and after surgery, and counseling and family stress and relations and all of those things as indicators. And we were able to present all of this to the highest level, to the Ministry of Health, and to convince them, and eventually by making it very public, about both, by posting about it all the time, talking about it all the time, on interviews, on podcasts, and whatever, having discussions about it, being loud about it. We managed to lobby so that us two psychologists were employed at the end of the second year of our project there, that was completely self-initiated. We managed to get meetings in the Ministry of Health with the minister himself and with his aides and all those things, and kind of make it important to, like, not just bring it to them why it's important, but create this public pressure around it, around the topic, why it is important, so that one day they won't actually thought, okay, we can make a very nice campaign of this and make us look like the good guys. We're bringing psychologists and mental health services to the community, to an underserved community, and we let them take the cake and the prestige of being so kind and nice. But it was us in the behind that doing all that work so that it becomes a pressing issue for them to address it finally. And examples like this are many in my community, where people just say, okay, we've had enough, and go and take things where they need to be. And I'm inspired by this, and I'm motivated by this, and I love this about this place, the way that people can be generous to each other, take care of each other, do these initiatives with their time and energy and resources, with everything they have. But I really wish there was a more straightforward way to promote mental health policies upwards. So this is very, very lacking.
I'm inspired by your story, Maria. That's amazing that you were able to start that initiative and then, get it listened to by politicians. That's incredible.
Yeah. And it's also about raising awareness, right, at the end of the day, so that people know about this problem, because I'm assuming that's what you achieved by being so loud about this issue, is that you raised awareness about it and made it important. And yeah, I think in some countries it really works and it can have an impact. I think maybe in some other countries, if they're slightly more bureaucratic, it's a lot harder to do that work as well. Like, you would need to reach the highest person to be able to change the whole law, and that takes years to change. But I really hope that they place more importance on mental health in general when they're doing their public policies and how they are allocating their budgets for the year. But amazing work, Maria. I think it's really important that we have people like you and Priscilla that are advocating for these problems. So
I would like to propose that we just touch upon the topic of cultural competency and literacy in therapists, and what are their limitations and how to be aware of that. I think it's very important, and it would, you know, just reflect a bit on the other side of this issue, like when we are responsible for spreading bias, how we can stop that. And I would really like to hear what Priscilla has to say about this from her experience.
Yes, of course, go for it.
Yes. I think that a lot of this is to do with understanding their clients, because as we know, like, research shows that one of the main indicators of how successful a therapeutic treatment will be is the relationship. So it doesn't really matter which modality. It's really about how you connect with your therapist, which determines, you know, the outcomes. And I think, like, when I spoke about my experience earlier at university, if there isn't an effort to understand the patient's frame of reference or their lived experience, it's going to be very difficult to understand them and for them to open up. So one of the ways that this can be tackled is by having adequate training. And I know this is very minimal across Europe, but in the UK, luckily, we have quite a few different trainings. So even if you were to go on Google, for example, and you did like cultural competency training for therapists, you would find a number of different organizations, different price points, and then you can enroll on this training. And it will teach you about mental health issues in the Black community, African community, Asian communities, all the different small communities that we have, and migrant issues and all these different things, so that you can be aware of this. I don't know if you have something similar in your countries, but I think that psychoeducation for clinicians and therapists is really important, because we all have our biases that we're not aware of. And it's better to uncover these biases before you are faced with a patient in front of you and you are putting this onto them, because it's hard to undo the damage once it's already been done. So it's easier to take a preventative approach just in doing that competence training. I know during lockdown, there was a lot of discussion, especially in the UK and the US, around racial tensions. So with this, people even outside of mental health, just any industry where it was, you know, client facing, there was so much discussion around cultural competence. So I think here it's a very normalized discussion. It makes it easier to access. We have books, we have resources and websites. So I think just increasing that library of resources around you and finding them, which might be a barrier, because like for us, if we have those resources in English, I don't know for where you are, Maria, if you have these things and Sarah in your country, then you might have to access it through like a UK or a US organization. Mm-hmm. If you don't speak English, then it's going to be hard. Yeah.
Yeah, true. That's the entry level. I mean, you have to have it. But we don't have perhaps so many resources available and training specifically, because it is, I mean, it is a smaller country and it is rather homogenous. I mean, yeah, compared to the UK or compared to Sweden. We talk a lot about diversity, but in some other forms, shapes, and segments of the society, you know, about policies, about, I don't know, different types of physical resources in the end, but more rarely, I think, about mental health in the context of mental health and how to provide services to people with this specific cultural sensitivity and being aware of where your biases lie and how to uncover them. So we kind of lack this perspective a bit. There are some efforts, people try to bring attention to it, but it's not very prominent in the public discourse or in the therapeutic discourse in this community. So people tend to you know, therapists tend to serve their own community. So if you have a Macedonian therapist, they will work predominantly or mostly or 99% with Macedonians and with Orthodox Christians, you know, and you have the Albanian population will have Albanian therapists that work with them and their language and share their faith and all of those things. So we're kind of segregated a little bit in that way, but at least each community has their own professionals that they can, you know, easily connect with, trust, and work with easily. But this whole issue is really, really important, I think. And here we may not have a lot of events or seminars or trainings that are named, you know, specifically about this, but we do discuss it a lot. And I think it's a very, very important message to send also to young therapists and to, you know, people, folks who are beginning in this profession, that we cannot treat everyone all the time. And that is okay. It's not making us bad therapists, bad counselors or anything. It is just the nature of things. And it's kind of dangerous to believe that you can treat everyone or even aspire to treat everyone. So this kind of was an integral part of my training, that, you know, to just accept that I'm human and I cannot be squeaky clean from subjectivity, distorted beliefs, biases, negative attitudes. And, you know, it's totally okay. What that doesn't make me a bad therapist, but what could make me a bad therapist is to just go around blissfully unaware that I have this content inside of me and then project it on unassuming people, clients that do not come to me to be judged. You know, they come exactly for the opposite, and they do not deserve to be on the receiving end of my unchallenged bias. So it is very important to be aware, and that this is a message that I also find very, very, very important to spread around myself, to my colleagues, to my community, to all the mental health professionals, you know, to open these discussions about how we can be better by challenging our own assumptions. So yeah, this does not only allow us to provide effective and ethical therapy, which is based on objectivity as humanly possible, but really makes us, brings this humility to our work that we can really use.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's such a good point, is recognizing your own limitations as a clinician or therapist, that there are some individuals or groups that you may not be equipped to work with. And as much training you can do around, you know, inclusion and diversity, there still will be limitations. Even in myself, sometimes somebody will come to me for a consultation to see if we are a good match, and I already know that there are areas that I'm not great at, so I will often refer them on to a specialist service or to another therapist that I know, because I don't feel like I'm the best person to serve them, and it's always about putting their needs first. So I think that's really, really to know.
Exactly.
So many there are different aspects of diversity as well, like for example, where you live in a homogenous society, it would make sense that you don't have a lot of training around Africans, for example, because they don't exist very much, you know. So I think sometimes this is the beauty of actually connecting with other people in the mental health space, because now I have you in my mind, and if I randomly meet somebody next week, I'm looking for a therapist in Macedonia, I'll be like, oh, Maria's around. So yeah, I think that's really cool.
How can you, as a psychologist, kind of recognize these biases that you have and accept them and kind of just refer the person to someone that might be able to help them without feeling that, you know, like, oh, I'm incompetent, and projecting it on yourself instead of just acknowledging that you cannot be good at everything or free of biases?
I would say for myself, my training was from a very humanistic perspective. So with that, humanistic therapy is very reflective around the self. So a lot of my training involved a deep, deep reflection on what I'm not aware of. So I was asking myself that question all throughout my training, and it's something that I continue to do through supervision. So part of our requirements legally as therapists is to have a supervisor who is also registered and credentialed. So when you go to see your supervisor, they will always challenge you, even if you have taken on a client, for example, and you think you are competent, but there is something that isn't quite working or connecting in that relationship, then my supervisor will point it out to me and say, you know, perhaps there's a disconnect there. Maybe there is a bias going on within you that needs to be worked on, or maybe this patient or client is better for somebody else. So I think it's constantly not being afraid to look at yourself, because we all have internalized biases. And sometimes it's not just from our personal lived experience, it is systemic. So sometimes when I deliver cultural competence training, I talk about decolonizing the way we look at therapy, because a lot of the world has been subject to, you know, colonialism. And with that, we have internalized our colonialism. For example, power structures is something that I always try to communicate with therapeutic clients and workshops, that there is no hierarchy, because I am the therapist, I am above you and you are below me. We are on the same level and we are meeting like this, which I think is really important to somebody who always feels like they are already underserved or marginalized, or they are smaller than the majority. You don't then want them to come into a session and feel like I'm small again and you are bigger than me. It's leveling out. So always, you know, just encouraging people to understand that I'm here to be a mirror to your mental health issues, but ultimately nobody knows you better than you know yourself. I'm just here to kind of provide you with the tools to help you get from A to B.
Yeah, totally agree with this. It was very well put. Like, I can just add that it is not only good for us, it is required of us to have regular supervision that can uncover these hidden or unconscious distortions that we may bring around with ourselves, because we are human. And besides that, we also have personal therapy, which is also an aspect of basic mental hygiene that a psychologist therapist also should have in their life. And it is also a place where you can be provoked to build self-awareness, explore and work through your own emotions, experiences, beliefs, and all of that. So it is something that everyone in the field should rely on: regular supervision and personal therapy when needed, if needed, as long as needed. Further education, as Priscilla said, is also so important in all of this, to really go and reach out for that knowledge that you need to really become culturally sensitive and be able to work more efficiently with a larger, with more diverse populations in the end. And also regular self-reflection through journaling, through discussion with colleagues, sharing experiences, looking for advice, or just venting to someone who can understand and perhaps reflect back something useful to you, a valuable insight. All of these things can be, are integral, actually, from the experience of being therapist to someone else. You know, you never get to just, oh, so my work is done, my personal work is done, I'm a built person, you know, I'm a therapist now, I get to tell others what to do, or, you know, guide them, and my work is done. It's never like that. If you're serious about this, you're always in constant process of education, re-education, further education, and growth, and growth, and growth. So it is something that just comes with that territory.
But doesn't it also depend on who you are as a psychologist that you would want to learn more? Or is it the same for all psychologists that they, like, if your supervisor pushes you, yeah, I can understand that maybe, like, you can do some work, but then it's also up to you whether you want to challenge yourself as a psychologist or not. Mm-hmm. And if I feel like the supervisor also needs to be aware of these biases and so on. So it's like a ripple effect of, like, if you are not aware, and then your supervisor is not aware, and then their supervisor is not aware, then it's kind of...
Yeah.
You're right about that.
So I'm just thinking, like, I see how, like, for those who want to, like, improve and make sure that their services are as competent and adequate as possible, and make sure that they do not harm anyone, I understand that they would be doing all of this work, which is amazing, and that they have their supervisor to challenge them as well. But then I'm also assuming that there are some others that would think that they have done the reflection, but maybe it's just not deep enough, and that they I always had this image of like psychologists cannot be racist. But is that true?
No, I would say that psychologists are human beings, so they can have racism, and sometimes your biases are so deeply hidden that you might not even be aware. Like you said, you might not be aware, and then you might have a supervisor who isn't aware. So you're very correct. Sometimes it can be tricky, because if you live in a country where those biases are normalized, it's difficult for you to recognize that this is even an issue, because we all believe the same thing anyway. So it's going to be, there will be some like huge blind spots, which I think, so it's one of those things that only ever becomes challenged once you're faced with that issue. Like I might think I don't have any issue until I'm faced with a new type of person to work with, a patient or a client, and then I'm like, oh, this is an issue that I've never had to deal with before. You know, I can give an example from my training where it's not to do with diversity, but there are in our training there, it was often asked for us to reflect on like which topics would you find it difficult to work with, and I always in the beginning I was like, oh no, there is nothing, I can work with anything, everything is fine, and then the topic of paedophilia came up, and the sexual abuse of children, and that really stopped me. And I said, how can I find it in my heart and in my mind to have compassion for the person who is not the victim, but who is a perpetrator of such a crime? And that is something that I really struggled with and had to work with. And then when I started working in digital mental health, where it was anonymous, sometimes we would get, it was a children's service, but sometimes we would get people, because it's anonymous, they would pretend to be a child. And when you have some experience, you can tell if it's not really a child. So sometimes the conversation would start, and then, you know, they would give very graphic details of their interactions with children. And that was really difficult for me. So that's something that I didn't think about before. But once I encountered it, I had to go to my supervisor and say, this is something that I really find it hard to have empathy for. If somebody, you know, opens up to me and says, yes, I abused a child. Also because I'm a mother, it really, it's something that it's hard for me, and I'm still working through that now. So if somebody came to me for an assessment and said, I've just been released from prison and, you know, this was the crime that I committed, I would probably refer them to somebody else, because I still don't feel like I'm competent to work with that.
I mean, it is a hard topic to work with, so... Like, yeah. How do you go about finding that compassion? Like, is that?
Yeah. I think I would say since then my empathy has developed, and I can empathize from human to human, but the details of the topic itself, I know that I still need to work on myself to be able to give them the best support that they need. I probably wouldn't be the best therapist for that.
Yeah.
I very much relate to this experience. As a part of my training, one of my mentors in my education, for example, used to say, like, I'm sure that all of you can imagine yourself working with and feeling empathy for a group of women who are victims of or survivors of domestic abuse. But the question is, can you extend the same understanding and support to the abusers if you're in the situation to work with them, and to work through their experiences, the damage that they've caused, hearing their stories, or with prisoners who will tell you all about the damage and harm they've caused to society or other individuals? Can you really imagine yourself in that situation? And if you find that you cannot and you do not want to work with these people, you must refer them. You must accept your limits. It is the only way, the only thing to do. Because in the beginning, we were also like, I can work with everyone. They would also ask us, which are the groups that you do not want to work with? Which are the topics? Where are your limits? Can you feel them? Can you find them? And we're like, no, we love everyone. We can work with everyone. But if you really go a bit deeper into that, it's not that easy. It's really not that easy. I often find myself having contra transference and, you know, certain phenomena or resistance when I myself have a difficult time with certain topic and a client brings it. So I'm kind of uncomfortable, you know, threading around it. And I know about it, you know, I am aware of it because I have been so well trained to reflect, to feel, to be aware, to come into contact with what I'm feeling right now in this moment. And when a session ends, I can sit down and say, okay, what happened to me? You know, what happened to me? And I can then bring that content to my supervisor and work through it really and get some guidance on, you know, interpreting it and taking the best course of action for the client in the future and for myself, because sometimes you also have to protect yourself. You do not have to work with everyone by any means. It's kind of part of the process where you are used to reflection and you're used to questioning yourself all the time. Okay, what is happening? What's happening now? What am I in contact with now? Am I truly in contact with this human being, or am I in contact with my own experiences, thoughts? You know, something internal is going on. So, and how can I get back to this contact? Am I able to get back to this contact? So it's really, it's kind of a mechanical thing after a while to do this for yourself throughout your experiences.
Well, let's hope all of them do that.
And I just wanted to add that what Maria and I have just mentioned is the difference between speaking to a trained professional and just speaking to a random person. Because oftentimes people will say, can I just go and speak to my mom or my friend? But this inbuilt reflective response is the result of our training and our experience. So, you know, that's why it's a safer space to speak to a trained and licensed professional, because we will have done work on our biases, but your neighbor down the street, they will not have done this.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess you also need to protect yourself from like the people that you're sharing your like deepest experiences with, because you'll never know if that person will go and share those with anyone else, whereas like a licensed psychologist or a professional is under oath of not sharing that information. So I think it's also to protect yourself that you should go talk to a psychologist probably, and you would get the professional help that you would need, because I know I've talked to my mom a lot of the times, but I feel like sometimes she doesn't really understand exactly what I'm talking about, or she doesn't give me the response that I'm looking for. Probably would not need that, but I probably would need someone that challenges me and what I'm saying. And I feel like with talking to someone that you know, probably they wouldn't do that. They would just listen in. And I think it's a difficult topic, but I, at the same time, talking to someone is better than not talking to anyone, because that person can also refer you to someone else to go and talk to them. But thank you so much, both Maria and Priscilla, for sharing your experiences. I was really amazed, and it was really insightful for me to hear about how you work with these biases, but also the systemic barriers that you've encountered in both the UK and North Macedonia, and the kind of work that is happening in parallel, like to reach these marginalized communities and provide the help. I think it was super useful to also know that work is being done, and it gives hope, I think. And for anyone that needs support, you can always reach out to us or go on app.pokemind.com or reach out to Priscilla. I think you can tell them where they can reach out to you.
Yes, our website is vivifytherapy.com. So if you're watching this, then we'll have a link in the description. And yeah, you can find us on Instagram, on just Google, and LinkedIn. Yeah.
Yeah. And Maria, do you have somewhere they, if you want them to reach out to you?
You can find me always in Pokemind and all the details around it. So I don't have anything else special working on right now where I can be reached. But I do devote a lot of my love and attention to this project, Pokemind, and the tools that we're creating. And it would mean a lot to me if people who might be listening to this try out the things that we're working on and see how they can make a difference in their lives.
Yes, or just give us feedback on how we can.
Just give us feedback. Please do. We need it.
Yeah.
We very much appreciate it. Yeah. And thank you, Sarah, very much for this invitation. I had a great time talking about these things with both of you. It's really important, and my knowledge is deepened and widened. And I'm also intrigued to really think about this further, discuss it further with the people that I know and work with here. So thank you very much for the inspiration, for the exchange of ideas, and for your time.
Thank you. I mean, I even I had to deepen my knowledge within this field before I came into this. So, and with your experiences, I definitely like know a lot more about what's going on and how things are in general within psychotherapy and so on. So thank you so much for joining me today. And yeah, see you in the next episode, everyone.
See you.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed this.